Tax season has arrived, and doing taxes without the right help can feel overwhelming. Intuit TurboTax is here now to guide you through it with confidence. Match with a TurboTax full-service expert who handles everything for you from start to finish. Your dedicated expert checks every single deduction and credit to help you get the best possible outcome so you can feel confident you're getting every dollar you deserve. And the best part? You'll see real-time updates on your expert's progress right on your phone while you live your life. Plus, you get unlimited expert help at no extra cost, even on nights and weekends during tax season. Visit TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Full Service Experts. Real-time updates only on iOS mobile app.
Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Miller. Delighted to welcome back to the show the President and CEO of the Center for American Progress. She was domestic policy advisor to Joe Biden, has worked for a lot of other Democrats. She is not at all polarizing on the internet. You might have heard of her. It's Neera Tanden. How you doing, Neera?
I just want to say polarizing means people like you too.
Yeah, right. Polarizing. Yeah. I always said that I was a polarizing child with teachers. I always made this case to my mother because she'd be upset because she'd go to parent-teacher conference. There'd be like two teachers that really hate me. And I'd be like, yeah, but there are five that I'm their favorite. You know, yeah. I'm a polarizing figure.
I'm hoping for that same ratio.
Yeah, I think that feels about right to me. Good news for you. Good news for listeners, because we've had some downer podcasts recently. There's a lot of schadenfreude out there today for the Trump administration. Things aren't going great for the Trump administration, which also means things aren't going great for the American people. So that part sucks.
Yeah, but that part's
bad. We're trying to focus on the political side of it and the problems for Trump. And we want to start with, I think, the most joyful element of schadenfreude, and that is Kristi Noem and her lover, Corey Lewandowski, have been expelled from the government. Donald Trump posted yesterday that he is pleased to announce that Mark Wayne Mullen will become the U.S. Secretary of Homeland Security effective March 31st. That's not actually how things work. It got to be confirmed in the Senate, but anyway. He says that Kristi Noem, who served us well and had numerous and spectacular results, especially on the border, will be moving to Special Envoy for Shield of the Americas. This is a made-up thing that's being announced at Trump's golf club on Saturday. So she gets a made-up job at Doral.
Totally made up. I mean, I have to say, like, you can almost tell how made up something it is by, like, just the title, right? So, like, right. The crazier the title, the more made up it is. And I mean, I have to say, like, I have been in an administration where you want to move someone out of a job and, like, they're basically being fired and then you give them something else, but usually it's an actual job. And if you're smart enough, you negotiate for an actual job. And the fact that they've just, like, totally made up Shield of the Americas, which is, like, I don't even know what that would possibly mean. I guess it's like defending Latin America from Russian attack. Yeah. Who knows? Anyway, just a fascinating, just like Linda.
I'm open to the possibility that Kristi wanted that job, you know, gets her away from her family. You know, I assume it'll be in a tropical locale.
Yeah, maybe.
Who knows? That's one theory. But she's gone. We can enjoy that. We have finally justice for Cricket, her dog. I want to talk about the negative part of this, which is Mark Wayne Mullen. But do you have any other Kristi Noem grave dancing you want to do before we do that?
Well, I mean, there's a lot. Whenever something like this happens, and, you know, we should acknowledge this is the first time a cabinet secretary, and this is a cabinet made of, you know, multiple people competing for the worst people in their jobs ever. So, but I do think it's the first time he's fired someone. And we should note, like, firing someone for this administration, why has he resisted it? Because he believes no one should make him do anything. And everyone has had carte blanche to be as incompetent or as horrifyingly cruel as possible. So I do think it's important to acknowledge that the political system in some way, shape, or form is impacting Republicans who then have become much more critical of her. So we should, you know, a lot of people are like, oh my God, he's so much worse than she is. It doesn't matter because of Stephen Miller. But I do think we should all acknowledge there is a victory in her going. ICE has not changed. The policies did not really come from her. But it is an important thing that the Trump regime needed to act politically in response to political pressure.
Yeah, and the Republicans did. I mean, this was John Kennedy, yeah. My senator from Louisiana, who's a buffoon and a clown. Like the fact that he felt like he had to be the one to really go at her and to put pressure on her. And he'd publicly said in other settings recently that they'd gone overboard on some of their tactics. And if the Louisiana yeah. Republican senator is saying that, like that is a sign that they at least have felt some political pressure and realize they need to recalibrate. We'll see how much they actually recalibrate. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that.
Let's talk about Mark Wayne Mullen. Here's the things to not be excited about this trade. And he's kind of the male Christie.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, they're pretty similar, I think, and they're just makeup, SAT scores, like the level.
I mean, they also compete on Psychofancy. Like, I mean, he's just yes. like,
yeah.
And also the fact that total he's named yeah. after he has this episode where he comes to the reporters and says, like, you know, the war is going well. And literally 30 seconds later, it's like, there's no war. Right. It's just like, you know, I mean, you know, like we're not talking about like a Mensa leader here.
No,
so.
It's not a Mensa leader. And he has not been critical of any of the policies Christie Noem put forth. And I just want to read a couple of things that he said. Mark Wayne Mullen, after Alex Preddy died, he called him a deranged individual who wanted to cause massive damage with a loaded pistol with an extra mag that was completely loaded. Obviously, this is ridiculous. He did not want to yeah. cause massive damage. On Renee Good, he said she was interfering with police activity. There's no question about that. They had the right to defend themselves. On the masks, he says that Democrats want reforms because they want to dox the agents. What do you want to do? Expose their faces so you can intimidate their families. So, you know, he threatened to fight a union head. He once said that he thinks that there'd be less fake news if there would be duels between reporters and Congress people like in the old days. So, you know, we're not pivoting back to Tom Ridge at the Department of Homeland Security.
I mean, look, we're talking about the Trump administration. So right. we're not like, I don't think we should expect rationality.
Yeah,
no. I think what's actually a little interesting about this is that the governor of Oklahoma yes. is actually a rational, seemingly more rational Republican. And he will get
he's
to
he's offered substantive critiques on the immigration issue in particular, which absolutely. Is interesting since he'll be able to put in a temporary senator. We'll see if he puts his money where his mouth is on that. But it's a little bit of a risk for the Republicans that in theory, he could put in a senator for like 5 or 6 months. That is
less crazy.
Yeah, he's not going to be Tim Miller, but maybe that he is sympathetic to some DHS reforms or something. We'll see.
I think the thing about this that's interesting and, you know, who knows what will happen. You know, it's not like I like to like bet my house on the ethics and morals of the Republican Party these days. But I do think that it's possible Governor Stitt puts in a, you know, just a more rational Republican who could create some breaks, not just on immigration, but a whole host of policies. And I mean, I think if you're like thinking of the array of buffoonery that's just on the field, it might be we have one less around us in this situation. So, you know, I try to be optimistic in these very dark times.
Here's another optimistic thing. I'll give you another element of optimism. So his confirmation, which still has to happen, Donald Trump thinks he can decree the date that he comes in. But as you know, there is a confirmation process.
I am familiar with the fact yeah. that you need confirmation.
Yeah. And a bunch of Republicans and even a couple of Democrats did not want to confirm you because you had said mean things about them.
Yes.
And so there's an interesting subplot to this, which is that the chair of the committee that he'll have to be confirmed through is Rand Paul. And here's something that Mark Wayne Mullen has said about Rand Paul in the past. I respect Bernie Sanders because he's a socialist, and you know that he's a communist, so you know what you're getting. Rand Paul is a freaking snake, and I understand completely why his neighbor did what he did. The neighbor beat up Rand Paul, for people who don't remember.
I would like to note, this is much meaner than anything I've ever said about a senator.
I was going to say, did you ever cheer a senator getting their ass kicked physically?
No,
I don't think so.
I don't think so. I think I called
Mark Wayne.
I mean, I think I called Ted Cruz Voldemort But I think this is worse, actually.
That holds up.
Yeah. I think it's, I mean, he's, again, he cheered an assault on
Rand Paul. I know, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah.
We'll see how Rand Paul handles it. But I think that there's at least some possibility that it's not quite as friendly as a confirmation as it could have been had, you know, it been one of the other Republicans for whom Mark Wayne Mullen has not supported physical violence against
him. I mean, it also, he could just slow everything down. Yeah, that's right. It's a favorite tactic of senators.
Rand is not like super excited about the DHS funding bill. This is all happening in that context as well, in part because of just his libertarianness. He's like against most spending bills. It's a little bit less about the principle of the behavior of the agents and all that. But like,
yeah,
it complicates things. Right?
Kind of credit to Senator Paul.
Yeah.
In the aftermath of the shooting, killing, murder of Alex Preddy, you know, he said, and I think this is basically, you know, animated by his concern about a federal government with almost unlimited power against citizens, you know, he basically said, like, he had concerns that the lies of DHS, the lies of Kristi Noem, the lies of, you know, the entire White House really, you know, should make people concerned. I mean, he was one of the senators in the days after that, and like Tom Tillis yesterday or 2 days ago in the hearings, who said, we could see this video and then we heard you lie about what happened. And, you know, I mean, don't want to like, actually, we've had a lot of disappointments from senators, Republican senators over the last year. But, you know, my own view actually is we are beginning to see more and more cracks in the Republican coalition. And the true libertarians recognize that Donald, I mean, who should be most concerned about an authoritarian federal government? It is the libertarians.
Right.
Unless you are a complete hypocrite, you should be very worried about a incredibly armed DHS that is shooting citizens on the streets of American cities. And I hope Rand Paul asks, you know, Senator Mullen, like, some questions about this whole situation. And it also just gives people more opportunity. I mean, just having this confirmation hearing will give people more opportunity to air all the problems, Democrats to air all the problems that have happened at DHS. So I think, you know, I mean, again, I don't want to overstate, but you do see some Republicans who within the blithering attacks are actually standing up.
And Rand has gone on, like, I can't remember if he's gone on Fox to criticize Noem. I believe so. He definitely did on the Venezuela strikes, and he has since the Iran war started.
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll watch Rand on this one in particular. All right, everybody, just recently got a package from our friends at Mizzen and Main. Mizzen and Main is offering some comfy dress shirts. Okay, and as a podcaster, it was getting criticized sometimes by people in the comments yelling at me. It makes me understand, at like the tiniest level, the burden of women. You know, it just makes me empathize with women just like 1% more, which is nice because, you know, everybody gives me feedback on my outfits and, you know, they say I dress too slobbish. And one solution to that is our friends at Mizzen and Main, who offer comfy dress clothes that look good, make you look fancy, but they're also comfy if you got to sit in this podcast chair for a year and a half. Mizzen and Main makes classic menswear with performance fabrics, so it's effortless to look sharp and feel great. They invented the performance fabric dress shirt over 10 years ago, and since then they've perfected it with modern fabrics. Mizzen and Main shirts and pants look refined, yet they're stretchy, lightweight, moisture-wicking, wrinkle-resistant, and completely machine-washable. No ironing or dry cleaning. Very important for me, because I don't even know where my iron is. It's a timeless style you can invest in one time and enjoy for years. Right now, Mizzen and Main is offering our listeners 20% off your first purchase at mizzenandmain.com. Promo code TheBulwark20. That's Mizzen, spelled M-I-Z-Z-E-N, and Main, M-A-I-N.com. Promo code TheBulwark20 for 20% off. Mizzenandmain.com, promo code TheBulwark20. And if you'd rather shop in person, you can find Mizzen and Main stores around the country. We're going to get to Iran. We have another news item this morning, which is the jobs numbers came out and it was a big miss for the economy. 92,000 jobs lost. Just want to read a couple of items for you. Here's Nate Silver. On top of the 92,000 jobs lost, also 69,000 in downward revisions from December and January. Not nice. manufacturing jobs minus 12,000, transportation warehouse minus 11,000, construction minus 11,000. So that this was going to be a renaissance for the forgotten man, the blue collar man. Doesn't seem like it. Ron Insana over at CNBC said, since Liberation Day, since the tariffs, workers have been liberated from the yoke of work. Net 19,000 jobs lost since last April. The labor force participation rate has erased all of the gains of the last 4 years while inflation advances. It's bad.
Yeah. I think the last point is really crucial. Donald Trump became president in January. And since April, we have not had job gains. And I just want to remind everybody that in the previous 4 years, we were averaging about 200,000 jobs created a month. So it is a radical break from what we've been experiencing. In the first Trump administration, it was basically 100, 150,000 on average until we got to COVID. Of course, with COVID, big job shock. But then as we came out of COVID, and, you know, not just in the immediate aftermath, but, you know, through last year, we were seeing significant job creation across the country, and not just in healthcare, but in manufacturing and jobs kind of throughout various sectors. And the most important thing is, you know, there aren't like other forces in the universe. I mean, we have to see what AI is doing, right. But it's the policies of this administration that are creating headwinds for the economy. I mean, a big reason why we're seeing these job losses is because Donald Trump decided himself to create a tariff regime that just made everything a lot more expensive and made imports into the country to make things more expensive. That's why it's so, you know, that is why we're having a manufacturing problem in the country. It's like the whole idea of his tariffs were to make, you know, to help us compete. And actually, they are, like a lot of things this guy does, boomeranging into hurting the very people he said he would help, which is working class people.
Yeah.
And it's like, what's going to get better? Like, that's the big question. It's like, what are we doing? I mean, maybe we'll spend hundreds of billions of dollars on this war and we'll get some people to work in like defense contractors. But what is on the table here to actually improve the economic conditions?
This is the key point. Yeah, it was self-inflicted. It was
100% self-inflicted.
It was totally self-inflicted, the job losses. And there's no plan. It's not as if that there's this bill going through Congress, like the Jobs Act, where they have a plan, where they're going to, you know, support certain industries or cut.
There's no idea. I mean, that's like, just to step back, what I thought was so amazing about the State of the Union, which I know feels like it was 7 years ago, but it was really like last week, is like,
was it really last week?
I thought maybe it was 2 weeks ago, but it wasn't. But now, you know, where the problem with time is like none of us can remember what happened last week because it's like last month. But the thing that I thought was fascinating about the State of the Union is, I mean, I've worked on a couple of these, and the idea of the State of the Union is that you're supposed to put out ideas about solving problems that compete with the other side. And there was nothing the president wanted to do in Congress because, you know, basically I don't think he cares what Congress does. He just wants to do executive actions. And it really weren't ideas there on, like, how are you solving the jobs problem? Because he can't admit there is a jobs problem. I mean, his whole problem is he kind of adopted one of the strategies of the Biden administration, which I'm here to tell you did not work so well, is to say, actually tell people the economy is really awesome. And what is horrifying is right after they say the economy is awesome, like the next jobs report is pretty devastating. And he can't even blame some woke BLS administrator because he got rid of that person. So anyway, it's
and back
really,
to the AI thing, just to like just like looking at a couple of the sectors, right? So maybe AI is having an effect on this. Derek Thompson and I were talking about this yesterday, but you know, in like the sectors that you would think, you know, kind of information services, that's kind of, you know, thing. It's like minus 11,000 jobs. So it seems like maybe there's an effect in these kind of white collar jobs. But like, that's just a small piece of this. I mean, like huge losses in hospitality, healthcare, manufacturing, warehouse. Like this is not AI.
This is a really important point. I mean, what is really terrible about this jobs report is that the jobs we're losing are jobs, again, disproportionately working class people are in. manufacturing jobs, hospitality jobs, service jobs. And you're absolutely right. The areas that we know are most impacted are computer right. programming, financial services, and we're not seeing that. So you can't even blame
financial services was the best sector, plus 10,000.
I know, exactly.
I assume that's because of crypto. I don't know. They don't break it down. But there's a lot of crypto crime jobs out there. Yes. We've got a couple booming sectors. Crypto crime, private prisons.
Briberies. You know, just anything involved in bribery is probably, you know, on an up trajectory these days. So, I mean, I don't even know who's a rational actor in the White House, but the whole thing about serving in government is you look at data like this and you have to think about what to do about it. And the fact that we have this from an economic perspective, the fact that we've launched a Middle East war that is spreading throughout the region and is like basically shut down the Strait of Hormuz while increasing gas prices, you're also basically creating a choke point on global trade, not particularly helpful to economic growth either.
Well, let's talk about the economics of the war, then we'll get to the rest of it. But just as you mentioned, so we have from this week since the war started, gas prices up 11%, oil prices up 20%. So seems like gas prices more room to grow there. Catherine Rampell wrote about this, if you want to get economic dorky for us, called warflation. So we've got some warflation coming. And then a subtext of this story is Susie Wiles. There's a leak that Susie Wiles got mad. It's so interesting. We've never heard that Susie Wiles got mad. I mean, we killed American citizens. I don't think she was mad. We were sending people to foreign gulags, not mad, but like mad about gas prices. She's mad. She was yelling at them to find ways to lower prices. Apparently, idea number one, because this is the only thing they've done, was the U.S. Treasury eased sanctions on Russia and Putin. And they can now sell oil to India and other countries in Asia without the same level of sanctions that we'd put on them. So that was idea one.
Were you not shocked that their go-to was helping Russia in the war? I found it personally just like I read it and I was like, oh, my God, this is so radically different than everything else they do is helping out Vladimir Putin in some form or shape or form. I mean, just to note that they are basically easing the sanctions on Russia while Russia is helping Iran target U.S. forces, in the war. Why? Because they're allies with Iran. So I just want to, for all the America First people, we are making it easier for Russia to have economic wealth. You know, this is like a whole issue for their economy, whether the sanctions exist on their oil and resources. And while they are actively working against our military operation. So, you know, it's very odd. But I guess, you know, one thing that I also want to say about just the utter incompetence of this White House is I don't know about you, but to me, it was kind of predictable that when you started a war with Iran, it might have some pressure on gas prices. I mean, I don't have Anthropic Claude systems like gaming out war to me, but for me, it occurred to me that could happen. Yeah. And you know, one thing you might do if you were thinking of having a war with Iran was to ensure your strategic petroleum reserve was actually full. So if gas prices went off, you would actually have some escape valve to, you know, increase production into the market to ensure that, you know, people were insulated. Not this group of crackerjack thinkers that actually did not fill the strategic petroleum reserve. So they can't do what governments have done, like Republican and Democratic governments, which is when you see an oil shock, you could actually tap the reserve to mediate the price. Nope, don't have that option because these geniuses didn't think to actually increase the reserve. So, I mean, this is the problem with having a war in like a weekend. You know, right. I mean, generally speaking, you plan these things out, you look at various contingencies, and you decide to ameliorate kind of the harms. But this group is perfectly fine with all of us paying more for gas. Other than Susie Wiles, they seem perfectly fine with all of us paying more for gas. We're all paying for this because it's $1 billion a year.
And they're adding a new 15% tariff back on. That's today, I think.
We're going to pay more in tariffs and we're paying higher gas prices. So far, lot of costs.
It's
crazy.
It's interesting you say that about the timing, because there's kind of mixed reporting out there. And we've seen some reporting that, like, you know, they've been planning this for 6 months. And it is true that we moved resources after, over there. On the other hand, there's been some reporting that, like, Bibi and Trump had a call, I guess it would have been a week and a half ago now, where they were like, hey, we've got the intelligence on that all these guys, the Ayatollah and all of them, are going to be in the same place. Like, this is our opportunity to go. This was not something that was urgent, right? It is not as if there's any reporting that's like, hey, they were about to shoot a ballistic missile at Maine, right? Like, that was not on the table, right?
All so of that is ridiculous.
You know, if they felt like this was an important strategic imperative, which they haven't really made the case for, but if they felt that way, they could have done it whenever. Like, the only timing constraint here was allegedly, like, that there was intelligence provided that they had this opportunity to get these guys on Saturday, and so they went in. But it's like, okay, well, if it's that critical, you know, that you go on the BB timetable here, then, like, there are going to be these other externalities, like people stuck over in the Middle East, like gas prices going up, and it doesn't feel like they gave a fuck about that.
Look, I think the Iraq war was just a generational disaster, but there was a buildup over a long period of time, and just think of the differences, okay? Number one, look at the harms people are having. You know, it seems like some of these soldiers were killed that should have had warnings about the war so that they could, you know, basically be protected. Number two, we have, you know, thousands of people in the Middle East stranded. The embassies haven't pulled people out. Usually when we go to war, we pull people out of embassies. You know, that happened before. And, you know, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve wasn't filled. We didn't engage with our allies really at all in Europe. I mean, I still consider them allies. I know this administration doesn't. But now those allies are basically on their own, choosing to help various sides in this war. Right. I know there's, like, a lot of kind of important talk about how the military is doing a great job degrading Iran. And sure,
that's true.
And that is true. And it is important to acknowledge. But the things around this, in my lifetime, the height of support for a military engagement, a war, is the days after the first bombings start going off. Right. The fact that the president has never been able to make the case as to why we have to do this. And, you know, I'm being a little glib, but at least the Bush administration had the dignity of lying to us about weapons of mass destruction. These people are like, one day it's Khomeini, the other day. Now they're like, they were about to bomb us in 2 weeks. And, you know, that would have been maybe compelling if you said it before the war, but you didn't. Well, so
we have an updated missive on what the plan is. Are you ready? Donald Trump has bleated about this morning. Here it is. There will be no deal with Iran except unconditional surrender. After that, and the selection of a great and acceptable leader, we and many of our wonderful and allies will work tirelessly to bring Iran back. Iran will have a great future. Make Iran great again, MIGA. I mean, we're doing regime change and democracy promotion. And Donald Trump said to Axios, who are his favorite sources for his war planning, so we have to take this at face value, that he gets to pick.
Yeah.
So that's the plan. We're going to bomb the fuck out of him. We're going to bomb a school. We'll get to that next. Mm-hmm. And we're going to bomb all the leaders. We're going to bomb the second and third tier leaders that we thought we were going to put in. They're all dead. And now we're just going to say, hey, you guys surrender.
I mean, I would
gonna
say,
like, okay,
what's, like, you know, obviously somewhat terrifying about this whole situation is it does feel like they thought Iran would be another Venezuela. And
yes,
Iran has been engaged in essentially, you know, its own version of hot/cold wars in the Middle East for decades. And, you know, it's not like I think when Trump came in, they thought their future was so safe. So, you know, they've done a range of planning. So they have leaders. I mean, you can take out a bunch of leaders and there still will be another leader. Like, the regime is operational. And, you know, I guess I on top of all of this, the fact that we are relying for this war operation on Pete Hegseth and his department. I mean, I know that there are generals there with who are thinking rationally about all this. And that's probably why they were leaking last week that they didn't really want to do this war, and definitely leaking earlier this week that it was like essentially the White House who wanted to do all of this. But I mean, I think we should just be genuinely panicked that they don't seem to have any kind of plan. I mean, I worked in an administration. Joe Biden did not start.
Okay,
wars.
The blob.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
oh my
now
God.
We know what the leftists are going to say about you. No difference.
I was against the Iraq war from the get-go. Just want to get my Stewie cred on that. Did some protests, et cetera.
I was against in 2006. I got a fight over Thanksgiving with my mother about that over in 2006. So 3 years too late, but okay. Better than some of the other Republicans.
Yes, that's true. But anyway, I just think the fact that, you know, usually you need disciplined talking points on your goal, strategy, et cetera, that the fact that there have been seven different aims and goals of this operation since Saturday, so just, you know, one more than the days of the week is, you know, I think we should be, you know, hyper-stressed. And I think that's reflected in the fact that the public does not support what's happening. You know, I mean, essentially, this is the lowest support of any military engagement that the country has experienced in this early in the process.
Are you a fraud-paying American? It's a fact that one in four honest, hardworking, tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity theft. With LifeLock Identity Theft Protection, though, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, and get you your money back. Last year, the IRS flagged over $16 billion in refunds for identity fraud. That's billions of dollars that could come from your salary, overtime, or second job. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second for your personal information and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. And if your information does fall into the wrong hands, only LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists who are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's 40% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
I mentioned the school. Mm-hmm. There's some good reporting. There's New York Times, a couple other outlets that are still doing reporting, unlike the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And all the evidence appears to be that it was us. There's a lot of smoke around the fact that maybe this was related to the AI, you know, because AI was doing the packaging for us. I don't want to make any accusations there, but there, you know, there's among the reporting, there's like some evidence pointing to that. You know, look, like on the one level, this is what war is, right? Like innocent people accidentally get killed during war. Innocent people got accidentally killed when we were leaving Afghanistan because like the Biden administration thought that there was a terrorist in a car. You remember the story? And they droned people that were innocent. So like this happens like in war. But in this particular case, I think it is especially galling because of all we've been talking about, which is like, we don't even know why we're doing this. We don't have a plan for the war. And now it is our like American material that resulted in the death of hundreds of innocent young girls. Mm-hmm. And now we want to go in and tell them that we want a MIGA. You know, like the whole thing, it's a farce. It's like really, and it's wrong. And it's a war crime. It's also a farce.
I mean, I think this will be an action that, you know, the military will be living with the consequences of for a long time. And I personally think it will have the kind of impact of Olive Grave. Yeah. And
I was thinking about that, too.
You know, just let's say we were attacked on 9/11 and the American military went in with soldiers. They didn't nuclear bomb the mountains of Afghanistan. They went in with soldiers to try to capture places. There were incidents of civilian deaths in Afghanistan. You know, a wedding party hit. We did not bomb entire schools of children during Afghanistan or Iraq.
And if you talk to the Iraq and Afghanistan soldiers, just to put a word in for them, like Will Selber, he used to write for us and others, like they went out of their way to not. Like, it doesn't mean that there weren't cases of civilian deaths. Like, of course there were.
They knew actually killing civilians made the population much more oppositional. I mean, just think about this week. Trump is basically telling the Iranians, you know, rise up against Khomeini or the Khomeini regime. Khomeini was a horrifying figure, but it's a little hard to for people to be like super sympathetic to the Americans when they just killed a school full of children. So this is why you do it. I mean, the military goal of avoiding civilian deaths is to ensure that the population does not work against you. And it took America months to pacify Mosul. Why? Because we didn't just bomb the whole area or kill, like, basically we had to do strategic, hard work with people, you know, our soldiers going like basically block by block in order to not kill so many civilians. And, you know, and just let's remind Pete Hegseth with all of his rhetoric, we're not going to like limit the military anymore. And we're, I mean, just think about what that means. It means things like this are more likely to happen. And the fact is that the whole world can see that the United States chose to have a war. It was not, it was a war of choice. There was no imminent threat to the United States.
And we weren't attacked. We weren't attacked.
And, no, and there was no attack.
Their post-hoc rationalization for all this is like, well, we've always been at war with East Asia. You know, it's like, what?
But also it's like, and also, you know, I mean, just to say, those kids are killed in our name. I mean, that's the horrifying aspect of all of this. It's like, I didn't sign up for any of this. And the what's even worse is, okay, if he even said he was going to have wars and he got elected, sure. But he told everybody he wasn't going to do things like this and got elected. What is the island of people who are justifying this at this point? Because, you know, again, mass deportations, you could say the guy campaigned on it. But he said he was going to be the peace president and we're like on war number 27 in the first year.
Yeah, I have a guest I'm going to talk about this with the next week who's on the MAGA side of this. But he's like, the people that are for this are kind of like the never Trumpers that stayed Republicans. That's like the opposite side of the coin for me, right? You know, it's like the hawks. Right. It's like the right wing hawks that hated Trump. Like, and all of a sudden, like the Mark Levins and the Ben Shapiros, and now they're backfilling this. And like, they're the only ones for it. Like, it isn't the core Trump voter that was for this.
John Bolton is like, peace out on this. I mean, even he's like, you know, yeah. I mean, I think he's been fantasizing about War of the Rand for his entire adult life. And even he's like, I'm not sure this is like well planned.
Yeah,
I
no
mean,
shit.
I think the problem, honestly, is absolute power corrupts. Like, there have been no guardrails on this president because the Republican Party and the Supreme Court, also made up of Republicans, have refused to give him guardrails. He had success in Venezuela. So he kind of decided to just like start a global war. And this is at bottom the reason why you try to find a rational adult to be president of the United States. Because when you do not, they have a lot of toys that could really hurt not just America, but like global peace.
Yeah.
And I do not sleep easily at night knowing these people are in charge of an ever expanding war in the Middle East.
You're getting me madder and madder as we talk about this. But like, it's also just it speaks to the
I'm
like,
definitely
lack
not
of,
trying to get you less mad about this war.
But it is a culture, like you talked about how absolute power corrupts, right? But that's really where we are.
Yeah.
Like it's a culture of corruption and no accountability. Like this is a thing.
There are no limits. Like nobody is telling this guy no. Like
nobody,
and when nobody tells you no, and honestly, like you fire anybody who's not psychophantic and you spend all your power trying to just discipline any institution, whether it's Netflix and losing out or any other group, then, you know, then like the problem is you don't think I can make mistakes. I mean, I really was genuinely, you know, a little surprised that he decided to do this because in the past, he has seemed to be constrained by the idea of American soldiers dying overseas.
No, he said it again today. More people will die, whatever. Something like that. He said that to Time. Some people will die. If there's no constraints, if everyone in there has already been so corrupted, right, that they decided that, like, I've signed up for this. This guy, we know this guy is bad, but I'm going in there because I think on balance I prefer him or because I'm MAGA or because I'm also corrupt. Whatever. Like, everybody that has gone in there made the determination that if you sign up for this, like, you're signing up for it all. And so that has created, like, a culture that we haven't had in government for a long time. Like, you mentioned Abu Ghraib, which is horrible and horrifying. But, like, there were whistleblowers right? I mean, there were whistleblowers within the military that were speaking out against Rumsfeld and felt like that they had to, and the policies. And then there were political people, the whistleblowers, and quit. Scott McClellan quit. And it would be like Carolyn Leavitt quitting. Like, he was a White House spokesperson. He quit over it, right?
Yeah.
And so it doesn't make what happened in Abergray better or right, but it's a system and a process. Yeah, it's a system and a process that works. That's not happening here. They're lying still. They're not even admitting they killed the girls at the school.
Yeah.
They're still lying about it. Like, forget having whistleblowers or constraints or internal investigations. They fired all the JAGs. We don't even have military lawyers anymore. Like, it's fucking sick.
Look what happened in the first couple of months of this administration. I think the administration, which has been incompetent in every possible way, has demonstrated policy creativity in two arenas. One, how do they come to power and basically eliminate all possible oppositional voices? So that's why they fired a bunch of admirals and generals in the first couple of days. And they've fired a bunch of people, some of whom are now running for office, but they fired, basically hatcheted a bunch of military leaders who I think they thought would offer some opposition and not just go align. And that sends a message to everyone else in the military, which is that if you say anything, you will be fired from your job. So that's an area where they've had some policy creativity, and the other is in rank corruption. But, you know, the truth is, in government, in every administration, you know, when you serve the public, you are supposed to serve the public. And all of us who've served in jobs in the White House or in the administration or in the executive agencies, you have to ask yourself every day, you know, are you truly serving the public? And, you know, I mean, I didn't feel like I had that many conflicts on that, but, you know, like when I was serving, but in the first term, there were of the Trump administration, as you mentioned in the Bush administration, there are people in government who think, I am a Republican appointee and I am an American who is supposed to serve the country. And there were, when there were conflicts, they chose to be Americans who serve the country. You know, John Kelly, others who were trying to constrain this president, and he has systematically eliminated everyone. But, you know, you mentioned Susie Wiles earlier, and it is her job as White House Chief of Staff to tell the president he should not or cannot do something for the country. His White House counsel is supposed to not just tell him how he gets to do things, but when he's doing something unconstitutional or illegal, that he should not do it. It is your job not to just service the president's ego, but actually to serve the country. And when people are doing it, when you're the president is doing something gravely crazy, I mean, how is Marco Rubio escaping any accountability here? He could have gone to the president and told him, this is like, you know, kind of nuts what you're doing. And, you know, what I've heard is that he was sort of like, eh. And so, you know, I mean, I think they all just tell themselves he's a president. He's the one who's elected. But, you know, they are there in those jobs not to just do his bidding, but like previous administrations, serve as some kind of constraint. Because right now, the scariest thing in the world is that Donald Trump is in charge of, like, you know, essentially whether this war spirals out of control or not. And the first week does not seem to be any kind of, you know, reassurance. Like, if we can't protect American citizens in the Middle East to get out of there, how do we think we're going to handle this war in 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, or 6 months?
I would move on to politicking, the Senate map. I've been saying for a while that I like the Democrats cannot consider this to be a good midterm or a blue wave unless they also take the Senate. Like, the taking the House is not sufficient. They're going to take the House just because of structural forces, almost certainly. Mm-hmm. The Senate is where the fight is. I've been pretty skeptical of the Senate map for a while.
But now you're believing.
The Iran war and the economy has me starting to believe a little bit. So I want to talk about it a little bit. I want to put the main Senate race over here into a side bucket, and we're going to come back to that at the end.
Oh, great. I'm so excited to talk about the main Senate race. Can't wait for that.
Let's focus on the rest.
Filibuster as long as possible now.
We're going to make it to the main Senate race. We can have an extra long podcast if you want. So no, the filibustering won't save you. You can do the thing where you pretend the audio went out if you want. The Democrats need to win 4 seats. 3 would be okay, because the Republicans would still be in control, but it would put Murkowski in an interesting pickle. But they really need to win 4, not 4 seats. Mm-hmm. North Carolina is a race we don't talk about that much because the Democrats have been acting competently. They've nominated a popular governor, former governor, that fits the state, and he's winning in the polls, and we'll see how that shakes out. There are also some states that Democrats need to hold.
Michigan.
Michigan, Georgia, but in this theory, like, we're going to assume that they've held them, or else this conversation is moot. So now you start to look into the expanded states. Where do you get some other states out of? Mm-hmm. In Texas, you had the primary this week. Tallarico wins over Crockett. I want your take on that. You look at Alaska, mm-hmm. is one that I'm looking at. Mary Peltola is a great recruit.
Fantastic recruit. Fish Family Freedom.
Yeah, Fish Family and Freedom. Now you start to get into, okay, Ohio, Sherrod Brown's a little bit of a retread. Iowa candidates are okay. Montana then comes onto the map this week, which is exciting. Steve Daines drops out 3 minutes before the filing, which is an attack on democracy and embarrassing and sick. And they squeak in some guy, though. But he's a prosecutor, but he's never run for office. So he hasn't been tested. Kurt Almy. The Democrats, it seems like, are going to do the thing that they did in Utah with Evan McMullen and kind of align behind an independent candidate. John Tester has been pushing this guy. He's a former college president. I like the independent candidate thing in theory. I know nothing about this guy. I worry a little bit. You know, colleges aren't really that popular these days among the swing voters.
I mean, he's a veteran.
So yeah, hopefully he's got some other parts of his bio. We'll see how that works out. Then you have Nebraska also with an independent, and Dan Osborne has been on the show. Interesting candidate. So the map is getting a little bit more interesting. I'm wondering, I just kind of want you to take me through what you got your eye on and your thoughts on Texas.
Well, I think the truth is, as you said, you have to win 4 of Maine, North Carolina, Ohio, Iowa, Texas, Alaska. So, you know,
Montana, Nebraska.
So basically, you have to win 4 of those multitudes, and they're all hard. You know, I'm not arguing they're not hard. I guess I would say, you and I have been in a few cycles in our time, and a sign of a wave is that where the map goes in the cycle itself. Is it expanding or contracting? And the fact that you have, I mean, I just think it's amazing. Steve Daines was like, I'm not running again. and it's not just he decided not to run. Yeah. Ryan Zinke, the House member, decided not to run. So that's a lot of Republican incumbents in a state choosing not to run for re-election in a time where Trump has a 37% approval rating, or 38% in the country. Obviously, it's higher in Montana. But I think at a very high level, what we're seeing is the reflection of an incumbent president with a below 40, probably, approval rating. And that means Republicans are, understanding that it's going to be a really tough election cycle. The reason why the Senate matters the most, or not the most, these both matter, the House and Senate matters. He needs the Senate to approve any nominees. And
Supreme Court.
If you take the Senate.
To replace Alito.
Yeah. And if you take the Senate, you're a check on the courts. He won't get radically crazy nominees through. And you can just say no to nominees, right? So I think it is really important to aim for both. And you know what I say about the race in Texas is Tallarico is an incredibly talented person. Jasmine Crocker, also very talented. They're like, and I thought what was great about this is it was a primary.
Did you think that race demonstrated a lot of talent?
You know, I think like she came into this race late and she didn't wasn't able to create the kind of campaign that he'd been building for a long time. But, I mean, I will say Jasmine Crocker lost Tuesday night. She goes the next day to DHS and has amongst the most effective questioning to the DHS hearing with Kristi Noem. Yes. And that's a woman who was rolling with the punches. That was very, she was really effective. And That's a real strength.
You could have sulked, could have pouted. And by the way, she's also really good at that.
Yeah,
you know,
she's
people
really
can
good.
Be good at different other at different yeah. things. You
and
know?
Honestly, the fact that I've been through primaries where yeah. it's a rough primary and it makes a candidate better. And James Tallarico is a better candidate today because he had to go up mm-hmm. against Jasmine Crockett. And I personally think this race is in within reach. And John Cornyn and Greg Abbott. Greg Abbott is going for his third term in Texas. Okay. And yeah. Cornyn is going for six terms. So it's Cornyn, six term Cornyn or Paxton. I think both of them have flaws against a candidate with just, you know, a fresh way of speaking. He's like not been there forever, who actually is really trying to build a big tent and has a lot of messaging that doesn't just start like yesterday, but over years of trying to create, you know, a pathway for Trump voters, Harris voters, Democrats, independents, and Republicans.
I worry just about a little bit of the incentives there because there's so much attention on it. And you mentioned Fish Family Freedom. I always bring this up. Like Mary Peltola has no pressure to like appeal to any constituency except for Alaskans, like yeah. left, right, or center. I'm not even really making an ideological point. Like she's just like, I'm going to run this race focused on Alaskans. I do feel like Tallarico and Crockett, because the race has had so much focus on it, and there's, you know, like there was this pressure to like appeal to various factions and interest groups within the Democratic side. Like when you list all those states, like the Montana, Nebraska, Iowa. I like James Tallarico, and I hope to talk to him on this and have him refute this worry. There was a lot of woke posting in 2020 from him with some weird stuff, you know, about white skin and having a virus. And, you know, it's
I mean,
just
he
like
was talking about racism. But yeah, yeah, I hear you.
I know. I it's just the way he was talking about it is like yeah. not really the way that they're talking about it in Midland is all. And I'm just trying to win a Texas Senate race. And I do worry a little bit that, like these races to get caught up in the discourse. It's like candidates are really on the left are really trying to appeal to the people tweeting at them. And like rather than trying to appeal to the 58-year-old that didn't go to college, that is the swing voter in these red states. I don't think that they're part of the discourse.
Well, first of all, I would say I think it is really important for people to remember that working class people care a lot about higher costs. So I guess to just pull back, I think yeah. a real opportunity in these Senate races and for Democrats writ large is we have never had a president who has just screwed over working class people as much as Donald Trump. I mean, like there's yeah. Ronald Reagan, George Bush, none of them took healthcare away from 20 million working people. Okay. None of them added basically a tax increase, basically a version of a national sales tax on everybody.
Sales tax.
And
yeah, right.
Who pays the tariffs disproportionately? Working class people. So I think at a very high level, there is an area of opportunity to kind of realign voters. And you're seeing who are the groups that have fallen away from Trump? I mean, people have talked a lot about Latinos. They've also talked a lot about young people,
young men,
but like really struggling working class people and people making less than 30,000 are moving away from him as well. And I think that's an area of opportunity. What's important for people to remember is that working class people actually care a lot about security. They care about reducing crime because working class people experience it at a higher rate than college educated people. They still care about the border.
I'm with you on all this. Is this part of the filibuster to get away from talking about the main Senate race?
It's actually a cap promotion, okay. which is that is why okay. the Center for American
okay.
Progress
Great.
Has put
I love
forward,
promoting cap.
Has put forward ideas that I hope, you know, James Tallarico and people and candidates all across the country will look at because we also have to offer ideas on how do we secure the border? And secure the border while not having a DHS. You don't have to, you know, you could basically secure the border without threatening everyone's rights. That's an area of opportunity for him to talk about. We can reduce crime without mass incarceration. So I think it's important for them to have ideas in those spaces. And I think James Tallarico, look, we've seen candidates recently, you know, in various places who are charismatic, who can, you know, kind of shy away from past positions. And I think he needs to explain his views and then, you know, early and often. And I have a lot of confidence in his ability to communicate.
AmericanProgress.org. People can go
yes.
look at those policies. And you have a great corruption tracker as well. That's
yes,
a little stuck
Trump's
up
take.
Before we get to the main. We have to talk about Maine because we find ourselves in a very strange position, which was me as the former Republican being like, I think some of these nitpicks of Plattner's visits to these podcasts and Reddit posts, they feel like nitpicky to me. And I have people on the internet yelling at me. They're like, he's a Nazi. He has a Nazi tattoo. And I'm like, does anybody actually think Graham Plattner is a Nazi? Like, does anybody think that Graham Plattner wants to put people into, I'm just going to make my point. No, yeah. Does anybody think that he wants to put people in concentration camps? No. Like, does anybody think if he gets in the Senate, he would want to advance policies that hurt Jews or that do to Jews what this administration is doing to Palestinian activists or Venezuelans or Somalis? Like, of course not. Like, of course not.
No.
So now, does that excuse his past comments? Like, no, like, we should talk about that. But I get a little bit frustrated with that. Like, there's a little bit of...
Well, you're kind of straw-manning the significance.
I'm not really.
Look, here, let me... I just want to say at the beginning of this, any discussion of this, I will love whoever the people of Maine pick, okay? It's really important to take this race. Yeah. And whoever people pick, I am like 1,000% supportive of. So don't really want to say much here to like that could be used against anybody in the future and by anybody. But I guess I'd say at a very high level, you know, I take seriously the idea that the Democratic Party is very focused on racism, sexism, and homophobia. And I think we should be sensitive to any concerns about anti-Semitism. That doesn't mean that anything that's happened here is Hitler or Nazi-esque or anything like that. But I think you could have like a safe, like it's a safe thing to say that was really not great. Okay. And not say this person is a Nazi. Okay. Yeah. Like I think there's a reasonable place to say I have some concerns. And maybe you could say, like, sometimes we sort of go off on the, we're too nitpicky. But I guess from my perspective, I think it's reasonable to say, hey, that stuff was not so great. I would also say, you know, what I think is fascinating about this race, which I will, like, really, I like to avoid talking about. But if you actually look at the coalitions behind Janet Mills and Graham Plattner, the funniest irony to me, not funny, but... like the people who are supporting, like at very high levels, Graham Plattner, are people who are making like over $100,000 in Maine. She's doing better with working class people. Yeah. He's doing better with the college educated people who think that working class people like him. So, you know, I mean, I just think this is like a funny aspect of all of this. Hopefully it all worked out in the end.
I'm glad you brought that up.
Because I'm just like, you know, I do think there is.
I agree with that. I want to go through the crosstabs now. I have 20 more minutes worth of talk about this race before I let you go. It is this deep irony, right? That Graham Plattner is appealing to like Colby College liberal arts graduates.
100% the people who are like, this is what working class people want. Right, guy.
And meanwhile, me as the former Republican is defending the leftist, and you are defending this the 79-year-old centrist that you'd think I'd be for. I just wish that we had another choice. I wish that we would have had somebody either 79. But yeah, and so this is the problem with politics. Unfortunately, we don't. The choices are Susan Collins, who is supporting and funding the terrorizing of brown people in her state. And I guess this is what I just keep coming back to on Plattner and why I just want to keep picking this fight with people is like,
okay, great.
If you show me, to my point, it's like, if you show me that he wants to do something like that, then I'm against him as I'll be at the front of the line being like, fuck you. But I just, you know.
Yeah, but your choice right now isn't between Graham Plattner and Susan Collins. Right, you know. The fact that you're like, well, as Susan Collins.
Well, your choice is between Graham Plattner and a 79-year-old that might let Susan Collins win.
Yes, and you... honestly,
like she'll be 85 at the end of her term. It's crazy. It's a crazy run.
As Susan Collins is 76 and Janet Mills is 79.
Well, it's crazy for her to run, too. I want the beer guy to get back in. Why can't the beer guy get back in? I just want a normal 45-year-old Democrat. Why can't I have that? Unfortunately, I can't. These are the options, I guess.
I think the thing to think about is what is the case Susan Collins is going to prosecute against Janet Mills, and what is she going to prosecute against Graham Plattner? And is she going to prosecute a case that Janet Mills is too old when she's 3 years older? Maybe she will. I don't know. That's like a great... she could. Like, you know, she's a wily... I mean, the only thing I'd say to
trans,
people...
pro-trans, probably. And again, she'll probably prosecute against...
I will support...
The race will be she's pro-trans,
yes,
I think.
Yes, but they're...
do.
you know, they're both very pro-trans, just to say. Yeah, it's one of his claims to fame. And it is like a very decent thing that he was defending.
It was kind of weird. He was talking about how he was wrestling against girls in high school 20 years ago.
Now you're just, you're definitely like way more into this race than I am. But if you know what's going on,
I don't think that's true.
But I guess my take, that's the thing for everyone to think about. And, you know, like, again, I will love and campaign or whatever, or not campaign, whatever's helpful for whoever wins.
Yeah, sometimes keeping Nira out is better.
Like maybe in Florida. But anyway, I think that's the thing to think about that race. And don't know.
I don't either. This is why it's interesting to talk about. It's frustrating to talk about and people don't like it.
The one thing I would say about this race is like, I know the Democratic Party is definitely like, and I get it 100%, like definitely not down with the olds. Okay. But
I have no problem with old people. She's going to be 85 at the end of her term.
But Maine is pretty old.
Yeah.
Pretty old. Old. And that's, again, I'd say like the great
irony
of this.
My issue about the Democratic Party is just like the DSCC. Like, why are we? Anyway, whatever. We are where we are.
Yeah.
We are where we are.
I mean, shouldn't we talk more about
Trump being terrible? It's fun to talk about it. It's not really fun to talk about it because everybody gets very mad no matter what your opinion is about it. It's a lot of high emotions about a state that almost nobody lives in or has been to. The commenters are very passionate about it.
There are people who I greatly respect who are in Maine who are like, this is the candidate, Green Plattner. And I maybe they're right.
Sadly, it's a very important race. And that is, I guess, why I just wanted to mention. Yeah. Sadly, this is the thing. Like, we wouldn't even talk about this if this was a primary in Florida or whatever. It'd be like, who cares? They're probably not going to win. Neither's probably going to win the race. But, like, the Democrats have to win. So figuring out who's stronger
is
pretty
important. They do have to
win.
But just also, you know, like, in 2020, that was a very tough race. She won by – Collins won by 10 points against a very well-funded opponent. So this is, like, important to think about. Every aspect of that race.
We're way over, but I have a final thing I want to leave you with. Not about Graham Plattner. There was an investigation. The administration keeps looking into new people. They're trying to jail people. They wanted to jail Obama. They wanted to jail Tim Walz and Jacob Frey. They wanted to jail Jim Comey. They wanted to jail Tish James. They wanted to jail the sandwich guy. They're struggling to jail their political foes.
Mm-hmm.
Another person, people, thing that they wanted to jail was Joe Biden and the auto pen and anyone who worked alongside the auto pen.
Yeah.
And that investigation seems to be fizzling. And I'm just wondering if you can talk about this, if you're concerned at all, if you're concerned having being in the administration, do you think that, are you shaking in your boots thinking about Pam Bondi and Judge Box of Wine coming for potentially you and other auto pen related staffers?
Yeah. So I should say to everyone, I was staff secretary and I oversaw the auto pen. And the most important aspect of this, which I told the House Oversight Committee that asked me about it last summer, is every time I authorized the use of the auto pen on any kind of decision, I had a memo signed off by the president for that. Now, my suspicion, since the only president I'm familiar with who has denied he knew anything about a decision that an auto pen was just used for, was Donald Trump himself. Last spring, there was a tariff action that was taken, and it was taken at like Friday at 5. Auto pen went used. I assume it was an auto pen and not a signature. It'd be more worrying if it was his actual signature and he couldn't remember he did it. Like, and he said he didn't know anything.
Didn't he also do this with the pardon, of the crypto?
Yeah.
Guy, think,
yes,
too.
He did so do that. There was an actual auto pen used for this or a signature for this. And so my suspicion is that it occurred to the people at the actual prosecutors that the only person that we know in America has had auto pen use without their awareness as president was Donald J. Trump. So I have not been quaking in my boots because I would feel perfectly happy to make that case to anyone in America. And there's no aspect of what I did as staff secretary or anything in which I acted in any way without the president's full knowledge. And we actually talk to the president about things we do and stuff like that. So I've never quaked in my boots on this.
So you think that you and the pen will continue to walk free?
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. I feel like I feel like it's almost good, honestly, because there's all these crazy, wacky conspiracy theories. And I kind of think, honestly, it's actually better when they're DOJ. Now I'm going to like induce them to prosecute me. But but like when they're DOJ is like, we can't find evidence, you know, like that. It's like it's a pretty good for the likes of Scott Jennings.
Near a tanned free woman. They can't get you, baby. They can't get you. They're struggling on their effort for political revenge. I appreciate you very much. Thanks for being on the show.
That was a blast.
On a Friday.
That was a blast.
We're going to take people out. We had a little vote in our internal production team whether or not to do this. And we're going to take people out with just a little bit of my favorite line from Corey Lewandowski, no longer a member of the administration. We'll see everybody on Monday. Bye.
Hey, this message is from Mickey. Mickey, your daddy, Papa Dickie, reached out to me and told me that you're toilet training. You must be a very special little boy, but I hear that you're starting to use the big boy toilet. So congratulations, and you're doing a great job with your poopies. Congratulations. I know your mom is going to be so happy for you, and I want to thank you in advance for being a Donald Trump supporter when you get older. All the best from your daddy, Papa Dickie.
The Bulwark Podcast is produced by Katie Cooper with audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.
Rewards programs are a lot like pop culture. They can be hard to keep up with. But with Venmo's new rewards program, Venmo Stash, rewards are so easy because the more you do, the more you get. And you choose the bundle of brands you get cash back at. It's giving fiscal queen. It's giving star. It's giving up to 5% cash back at your favorite brands. Just pick a bundle of your go-to spots to shop with your Venmo debit card and earn cash back at them. Do more, get more with Venmo Stash. The Venmo MasterCard is issued by the Bancorp Bank N.A. Venmo Stash bundle terms and exclusions apply. Max $100 cash back per month. See terms at venmo.me/stash terms.
Are you a fraud-paying American? One in four tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity fraud. With LifeLock, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Last year, billions in refunds were stolen. Could be from your salary, overtime, or second job. Gone. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.